body reacted. So did hers. His hands moved across her body as they kissed. They were naked a few seconds later, her walking backwards into her bedroom as they kissed. Sloppy, hungry kisses. They lost track of time. She never mentioned class, and he didn't say a word about work. In the living room, he could hear his Nokia cell phone ringing. He wouldn't have answered it if the world was ending. When they were spent, they lay in bed, staring at the ceiling the same way they had that first night. Her voice was soft, barely over a whisper. "I thought you were pushing me away." That confused him. He propped himself up on an elbow. She continued, still staring at the ceiling. "I figured you had what you wanted. The money, the stock that would make you rich. You wanted to give me my share so you could walk away with a clear conscience that you had done the right thing." The attorney had been right. Desmond really did have a lot to learn about women. "That's the last thing I want," he said. "I want to take care of you no matter what. No matter what happens to us, or to me. I'm sorry I hurt you." He was terrified that he would hurt her again. He feared that this was the first of what would be recurring missteps. "I meant what I said. I'm not a whole person, Peyton. Your friends, the couples we go to dinner with, those guys are what you want. Someone normal. I'll be the judge of what I want, and it's not normal. Plus, I've got news, Des. Nobody on this earth is really normal. Everyone is faking it to some degree, especially around here. A lot of freak flags flying on the inside." They got dressed then. Neither said a word, but there was a serenity in the air he'd never experienced. Before he left for work, he asked her again if she'd sign the documents. "I need to know you're taken care of, please." "Okay." She took his face in her hands. "If it's what you want." She signed her name in beautiful cursive letters, and Desmond kissed her before he left. She asked him again to come to Christmas at her mother's house that year. This time he accepted, but he wasn't looking forward to it. He still didn't feel comfortable around her family. But things had changed for him. He was a success now, with one IPO behind him and another looming. Her sister's husband treated him differently, though he suspected he knew the series of events that had led to that. Peyton had prevailed upon her sister, who had then spoken with her husband. Derek quizzed him about Cyanet and his other investments with the zeal of a kid trying to glean clues about his gifts under the tree. Their family was tight, Desmond could see that, and Peyton had told him the reason. The death of their father had brought them closer. Her brother's passing 7 years before had also strengthened their bond. Peyton said it had made them more thankful for each other, and every year they had together. The tragedies were a reminder to them of what was truly important. Her entire family couldn't have been nicer to him. He still felt out of place, like an actor in a role that was wrong for him. Fraud was the word that kept running through his mind. He told himself that there was simply a wall inside of him, that the emotions were there behind it, waiting to come through. When it came down, everything would be fine. He would soon learn the truth. Chapter 73 Desmond felt a hand on his shoulder, shaking him. He opened his eyes. Avery loomed over him, her pale skin and slender face like a ghost in the green glow of the plane's safety lights. Peyton lay in a sleeping bag beside him, fast asleep. Avery hadn't woken her, and apparently didn't want to. Her voice was barely over a whisper. "You okay?" He felt feverish and achy, he assumed from the memory, but he didn't want to give her any indication that he had recalled anything. "Of course. Why wouldn't I be?" Avery studied him. "You were feverish earlier. Anyway, we have a problem." "What kind of problem?" "The life or death kind." Avery informed him that they were about to leave Africa, cross over the Mediterranean, then into European airspace on their way to Scotland.
"And?"
"And," Avery said, stretching the word out. "If the Europeans have sealed their borders like the U.S., like they did in Kenya, they might shoot us down."
That was a problem.
"Can we go around?"
"Not enough fuel."
"Refueling?" "Is a bad idea," Avery said. "Every time we land, we take a risk. If we land at an airport, the host nation will probably take the plane and throw us in a cordon zone. That's best case." Avery motioned toward Peyton. Want me to wake Sleeping Beauty? No, Desmond said quickly. And don't call her that. She's tougher than you think. Avery seemed annoyed. It's not her toughness I have a problem with. She was just protecting her people on the ship, same as you would have done. Avery ignored him. What do you want to do? Who's the most likely to shoot us down? What? I have no idea. Who has the biggest air force? I don't know, the UK, Germany, France, Italy? What about Spain? Avery thought a moment. They've got the planes, but not enough money to repair them and keep them flight ready. Their economy has been in crisis for years. She nodded. So we fly over Spain, roll the dice, try to get to Shetland. Speaking of which, what happens then? Surely they'll shoot us down. I'm working on that. Before he could ask, she stood and made her way back to the cockpit. Desmond adjusted the rolled-up blanket under Peyton's head and watched her sleep for a moment. He closed his eyes, trying to remember his past. The Cynet IPO was a turning point in Desmond's life, in ways he never anticipated. The stock soared. On paper, his stake, a little less than 1% of the company, was worth $3.29 million. In reality, all of his options were subject to an employee lockup provision that prevented him from selling shares or exercising options for 6 months after the IPO. They were the longest 6 months of his life, and everyone else's at Cynet. Going public changed the company. The management team, now constantly obsessed over the stock price and investor relations. Quarterly earnings became the only events that really mattered. They issued press releases all the time, hoping to garner more media attention. Where they had thought strategically before, taken risks, and tried to build the business for the long term, now they played it safe, trying to hit their growth and revenue numbers. There were still no profits to report. It was the beginning of the end, and Desmond knew it. When the lockup period expired in August, the stock had drifted higher. A rising tide in 1999 had lifted all boats, most of all shares of hot dot-com companies. His shares were worth $7,840,000. He sold every one of them and resigned, including the proceeds from his stock options in two other companies that had gone public and one that had been acquired. He had netted just over $9 million in the last year. Peyton had insisted that whatever he did with his shares in the companies, she would do too. He sold everything and put the proceeds in two separate bank accounts. Separate wasn't what she wanted, in banking or otherwise. She had recently asked him to move in with her. He was hesitant, still afraid he would hurt her. But saying no would hurt her too. They bought a small cottage-style home in Palo Alto Hills. For him, it was the easiest move ever. He simply hooked up the Airstream, backed it into the driveway, and carried his few belongings inside. Despite their windfall, Peyton didn't change one bit. She kept going to med school, studied her heart out, and decorated the house in her free time. She painted every room, put wallpaper in the half bath. There was always a home improvement project for the weekend. Desmond was pretty good at them, but he figured half of her motivation was to give him something to focus on. In the months after he quit Cynet, he mostly lay on the couch and read, or surfed the web. The last 6 months while Cynet was public had been grueling. He'd worked long hours on endless deadlines. The year before hadn't been much better. Taken together, he felt like he'd crammed 20 years of work into 18 months. He was burned out, but that wasn't the full extent of his problems. He had believed that financial freedom would be a breakthrough for him, that he would feel differently. He thought that on the other side of that train tunnel, he'd finally relax and open himself fully to life, and in particular, to love. Love without fear, love with Peyton. But the wall was still there. He felt like a greyhound that had run the racetrack his entire life, chasing a stuffed rabbit, and had finally caught it, only to discover that the thing he had been chasing was of no use to him. That it had all been a fool's errand. He now knew the truth. His true issue was far deeper, at a more fundamental level. He read texts on psychology and researched it on the internet. Peyton became increasingly worried and presented a myriad of solutions. You need to exercise more, Des. You've been physically active your whole life. He got a gym membership and began running with her every morning. They swam every Saturday. It didn't help. Neither did getting outside. Maybe you need to actually interact with people, she said. I mean, being here all day alone would be tough on anyone. He joined a book club, began taking classes at Stanford on subjects that interested him, astrophysics and psychology. He went to lunch at least twice a week with old colleagues, but he felt no different. Peyton begged him to see a doctor. I feel like I'm watching you slip away, Des. Please, do it for me. At the family physician's office, he filled out a questionnaire. Inside the exam room, the doctor sat across from him and said, First, know that what you're experiencing is very common. Depression affects people of all ages, all races, and at every socioeconomic level. Sometimes it's temporary, sometimes it's a chronic medical condition that must be managed throughout a person's life. And it is that, a medical condition. I'm going to prescribe a medication, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, or SSRI. Many patients improve on SSRIs. In your case, with the severity of your symptoms, I would also strongly encourage you to see a psychotherapist who can identify other underlying issues that could be at play and help you identify triggers in your life that you can manage. I've seen many patients improve on medicine alone, but many more benefit from a combination of medicine and therapy. The psychotherapist the doctor recommended was named Thomas Jansen. He was in his 60s, with short gray hair and a kind smile. He listened as Desmond recounted his childhood and every major event up until he had walked in Dr. Jansen's door. The man took copious notes, and when Desmond had finished, Dr. Jansen told him that he believed he could help him. He just needed a few days to consider what he'd said. When Desmond returned, the man sat in a club chair, a notebook in his lap, and spoke slowly, his voice even. I believe you have a disorder we call post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. That surprised Desmond. I suspect you developed the condition after the bushfire that killed your family, and very nearly you as well. I believe you never recovered from that event. You never came to grips with that severe trauma. In fact, you were placed in a new environment with its own dangers and hostility, your uncle's care. Those first years were spent in near constant fear of starvation or verbal abuse from your uncle. In your work on the rigs, you were in physical danger. Your injuries attest to how real that threat was. And in the days after, when you and your uncle were, he glanced at the notebook, blowing off steam, that is, drinking and fighting, the danger and fear never went away. You also never got to mourn your uncle's death, or frankly, to unpack your feelings about him at all. You were in danger the instant he passed, even having to fight for your life, to kill a man, which is in itself an incredibly traumatic event. The fact that you processed it with little emotion at all is evidence of the vast amount of pre-existing emotional scar tissue. Our brains are like a muscle, Desmond. They become conditioned to the strain they must endure. We are an exceptionally adaptive species. We change to survive in the environment in which we exist. For you, that environment has been one of near constant danger. From the moment that fire took your parents, you have been in physical or emotional danger your entire life. Even after you came to California, you feared someone from Oklahoma would find you, arrest you. You feared you'd lose the money your uncle left you. But I believe perhaps the greatest issue affecting you is the people you've lost in your life. Your family. The librarian. He peeked at the notebook again. Agnes, your uncle, everyone you've become emotionally invested in has been taken from you. Not just taken, but taken at a moment when you least expected it. Your mind, subconsciously, is now trying to protect you. It has seen this pattern before. You want to love, to care, but the moment you do, the object of your affection is ripped away. It won't let you. You are at war with your own mind. Desmond sat for a moment, considering everything Dr. Jansen had said. Okay, let's assume I agree with your diagnosis. How do I fix it? Well, that's a tougher question. You didn't get this way overnight, Desmond. Nor will your condition resolve quickly. It will take time. And some faith on your part. Hope is also a powerful thing. He encouraged Desmond to continue taking the medication and to establish a regular schedule of 2 visits per week. The gloom Desmond felt was a sharp contrast to the euphoria around Silicon Valley. A new company seemed to go public every week, minting millionaires by the hundreds. Desmond was skeptical. Warren Buffett's adage, "When others are fearful, be greedy. When others are greedy, be fearful," seemed like good advice in the current environment. He invested his and Peyton's money in bonds. With a small portion of his funds, he placed bets against companies he thought were poised for a fall. Having been inside a dot-com startup, he could evaluate their technology and read through the BS in the earnings reports and press releases. He spent his days listening to quarterly investor conference calls and researching companies. Desmond's bets failed at first. In the fall of 1999 and early 2000, he lost nearly $500,000. It seemed to him like the whole world had gone crazy. In 1999, there were 457 IPOs. Most were high-tech companies. Of those, 117 saw their stock prices double on the first day of trading. And the euphoria wasn't limited to new companies. On November 25, 1998, Books A Million announced an update to their website. Their stock increased over 1,000% that week. Some companies were using their stock to snap up every hot startup they could. Yahoo bought Broadcast.com for $5.9 billion in stock, and GeoCities for $3.57 billion in stock. A Spanish telecom company acquired Lycos for $12.5 billion. A few years later, they would unload it for less than $96 million, a loss of over 99% of their investment. In January of 2000, AOL bought Time Warner in the second largest merger in history. During the Super Bowl that month, 16 dot-com companies ran ads. They cost $2 million each. The stock market soared and crashed. In March of 2000, with stocks falling as hard as they had risen, over the next 2.5 years, stocks shed over $5 trillion in value. People flocked to bonds, and Desmond's bearish wagers paid off. Their $9 million fortune was 19 at the end of 2000. 15 after taxes. He played it safe after that, diversifying and buying only a few high-quality stocks. Every week, Desmond heard about another one of his friends who had lost their job or seen their company collapse. He felt for them. The memory of XTV's sudden collapse and his days of pork and beans in the months after were still fresh in his mind. He did the only thing he could. He took folks out to lunch, always picked up the tab, and tried to connect people with jobs when he heard about them. Their stories were horrifying. The layoffs were nerve-wracking affairs. Large groups would be led into conference rooms and told they were being let go. Consultants handed out packets with details. In some cases, the consultants even surprised the HR people conducting the layoffs by handing them a folder with their walking papers, too, right after the dismissals of everyone else. The coffee shops that had teemed with bright-eyed entrepreneurs with the next big idea written out on a napkin were now packed with people working on their resumes, which they tweaked and proofread and scrutinized before printing them on thick paper stock so they would stand out. Startup execs, who had been worth millions on paper, found themselves broke, moving back in with their parents or in-laws. Many employees whose companies had gone public never made it past the lockup period to sell any of their shares before their companies folded. Desmond watched it all in disbelief. It seemed the world had only two extremes: charging up the hill wide open, or free-falling over a cliff. He was in his own kind of free-fall. Every month he grew less optimistic about his prognosis. The medication helped. So did the sessions with Dr. Jansen. But Desmond had plateaued. He wasn't making any real progress. Peyton was. He watched as she changed, little by little. She took pride in her schoolwork, was near the top of her class. She was blossoming, becoming an incredible woman. She was ready for something more. That worried him. He wondered if he could ever be the man she deserved. Christmas 2000 came and went. They had a little tree in the home in Palo Alto Hills and kept up their tradition of $10 or less in gifts. Peyton cheated, though. Hers was a box with a model airplane inside. "It's great. The airplane's not the gift, Des." She grabbed his hand and squeezed it. "Let's go on a trip. Back to Australia, to where you were born. Visit the remains of the home. Go to Oklahoma, where you grew up." He knew what she wanted. For him to visit the places that had caused him so much pain and somehow come to grips with what had happened and move on. He agreed. He was desperate enough to try anything. In Australia, he walked across the paddocks where he'd once played. He visited the thicket where he'd built the fort that day, even straightened the overturned rocks he'd set down 18 years ago. The house was still there, or at least its burned remains. He stood in the yard inside the fence where he'd rushed into the fire. There was no breakthrough. He didn't cry. He felt only sadness. They stayed in a hotel in Adelaide for a week while he tried to find Charlotte. But since Desmond didn't know her last name, it was impossible to find her. Over 100,000 people had been part of the relief efforts in the wake of the 1983 bushfires. And it had been almost 18 years. She might have left the area, or left Australia altogether. In Oklahoma City, they rented a car and drove south, through Norman, then Noble, and finally onto Slaughterville Road. He pulled off at the home where he'd grown up, Orville's home. It had been part of a farm once, but the farmland had been sold, maybe by Orville himself or someone who'd owned it before him. The new owners had painted the home and put on a new roof. The asphalt shingles sparkled in the clear April day. A Chevy truck and a Ford sedan sat under a newly erected metal carport. A red Huffy bike sat on the front porch. It was about the size of the one Desmond had bought at the pawn shop, the bike Orville had threatened to take away. The shed stood open. The old Studebaker was gone. Desmond's eyes lingered on the patch of ground where Dale Epley had bled to death while he held the lawnmower blade. Peyton put an arm around him.
You want to go in?
No, I've seen enough. They drove past the grocery store that had sustained him, up Highway 77 into Noble. The small town hadn't changed much. They ate at a small cafe on 3rd Street and walked the 3 blocks to the library. A girl a few years younger than Desmond sat behind the counter, a mechanical pencil in her hand, a large book open in front of her. Another University of Oklahoma student, if you had to guess.
Help you?
She asked. Nah, just looking. He walked down the fiction aisle, Peyton close behind him. He spotted a few of the paperbacks he'd read as a kid. Island of the Blue Dolphins, Hatchet, Hyperion. He could even remember where he was when he read them. The place had barely changed. The only addition was a wooden study carrel in one corner. It held a gateway computer with a 17-inch monitor. A plaque on the top of the carrel read, Pioneer Library System Technology Center provided in loving memory of Agnes T. Andrews. It was the best thing he'd ever read in that library. He took Peyton's hand. Let's go home. Chapter 74. In the plane's cockpit, Avery stared in disbelief. Spain was dark, except for a few glimmering lights in what she thought was Barcelona. They'd launched no fighters to pursue the Red Cross plane. Air traffic control hadn't even engaged her. She wondered what was going on down there, and how many people were left. On the navigation screen, their destination loomed, the Shetland Islands, north of Scotland. She'd never heard of the place. She wondered what they'd find there, at the GPS coordinates Desmond had provided. On the satellite map, there was only a forest. Was it a trap? Avery feared that it was, but she had no choice. She engaged the autopilot, stood, stretched her legs, and walked back into the passenger compartment. Desmond and Peyton lay in sleeping bags, both facing forward, Peyton tucked into Desmond like a little spoon. Avery leaned against the doorframe and stared. She'd have to make a decision soon. A hard one. On September the 11th, 2001, Desmond sat in the light-filled living room in Palo Alto, Peyton at his side, both staring in disbelief. The news channel showed a live view of Manhattan. The people in the buildings were burning alive, just as Desmond's family had on that day in 1983. This tragedy, however, wasn't a natural disaster. It was an act of humankind, the worst kind of evil, the sickening, cruel slaughter of innocents.
Something is very wrong with this world, Desmond said.
I couldn't agree more.
The U.S. stock market stayed closed until September 17th, the longest closing since 1933, during the Great Depression. When it reopened, stocks tanked. The market fell 684 points, the largest single-day decline in history. By the end of the week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down over 14%. The S&P lost almost 12%. Nearly $1.4 trillion in market value was lost in that week alone. While others were dumping American stocks, Desmond was buying. He returned to his criteria for identifying a successful company. A founder who instinctively knew what his customers wanted, and a tightly managed operation. He loaded up on stock in Amazon and Apple. On the news every night, he watched sabers rattle and the world go to war. He was mad as hell, too. He even considered applying at the NSA or CIA. But he barely had the energy to get out of bed. He seemed to get worse every month. Peyton saw it, was worried about it. What if you start your own company?
Doing what? Why? There's no point. I have no ideas, no drive to do it.
You could start a non-profit. Child welfare. Find something you care about and go for it. He thought about it for a few weeks, researched it, and began volunteering at a group home in San Jose. That helped him pass the time, but it wasn't enough. Deep down, he knew the truth. He was never going to change. He would never be able to love Peyton the way she loved him, with reckless abandon. It wasn't fair to her. She deserved more. In the summer of 2002, he sat in Dr. Jansen's office.
This isn't working.
It takes time, Desmond.
I've given it time. I've been coming here for over 2 years now. I've tried medication, exercise, volunteering. Hell, we even retraced the tragic events of my childhood. I'm not getting better. I don't feel any better than I did the day I walked in here.
Please realize that every person has emotional limits. Your range may simply be very confined. It's also possible that 2 years isn't enough time.
You want to know what I actually do feel?
Jansen raised his eyebrows.
Guilt.
The man looked confused.
I feel guilty because I know she'll never leave me, and I'll never make her as happy as she deserves to be.
That afternoon, Desmond packed his things. The gifts from Peyton he placed very carefully in a large trunk. He scanned all their pictures, printed copies of them, and returned them to their frames. He waited in the living room, and when she got home, they sat on the couch, feet from each other. Her nervous, clearly aware something was very wrong. He said the lines he'd rehearsed a dozen times.
I have this vision of you in a few years. It's summer. You're sitting on your back porch drinking a glass of wine while the kids play in the yard. Your husband is manning the grill, and he's playing in the backyard with the kids, and he knows exactly what to do, because he played in his backyard as a kid with his dad, who loved him. You all eat together, and he knows exactly how to treat you, because he grew up with an actual mom and dad, and they treated each other right. He reads a story to the kids before he puts them to bed, because his parents did that for him. When they act up, he knows what to do by instinct, not because he read it in a book, but because it's how he was raised, in a normal home. And he loves you, and them, because he's able to love, because he hasn't drifted from one tragedy to the next in the years before he met you. Your life isn't perfect, but it has a real chance to be, because one of you isn't broken beyond repair.
Desmond, I don't care.
I know you don't. I know that you will stay with me wherever our road leads.
I will,
but I won't let you.
Desmond.
I care too much about you, Peyton. You deserve to be happy.
I am happy.
Not as happy as you will be.
She hugged him and cried more than he'd ever seen her cry.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Please stay.
I'll stay the night.
She looked him in the eye. Stay until Monday, please. He agreed. They were the most agonizing and joyous 3 days of his entire life. They made love every night, and twice each day. It was a long goodbye. It was painful. Even he felt it. He couldn't imagine what she was going through. When he stepped out on the front porch Monday morning, she hugged him so hard he thought his ribs would collapse. He pushed back just enough to look her in the eye.
Will you do something for me?
Anything.
Don't wait for me. Live your life.
That set off a new bout of crying. An hour later, he was driving south, the Airstream trailer in tow behind him. He camped in Yosemite National Park, then Sequoia, and hiked through Death Valley. He read at night, and he thought long and hard about his next move. Each day, the solution became clearer. If he couldn't save himself, he would save others. That was a goal he could get excited about. That was worth living for. Before, his idea of setting up a non-profit or focusing on child welfare had been the right idea, but on the wrong scale. He wanted to do something big. He wanted to change the world, to help create a world where no one grew up the way he had. He set up shop on Sandhill Road. Rents there had once been the most expensive in the world. Now the former offices of a dozen recently closed venture capital firms sat empty. They were all decorated lavishly. Desmond negotiated as hard as he had with the pawnbroker for the bike so many years ago. He moved in the following week and began making calls, putting the word out that he had a new investment firm with a new focus. Thanks to the soaring stock market, he had $80 million to spend. Capital was in short supply in the valley. His inbox filled. The phone rang off the hook. But nothing was quite what he was looking for. He named his firm Icarus Capital. In Greek mythology, Icarus was the son of Daedalus, the craftsman who built the labyrinth. In order to escape the island of Crete, Daedalus created wings of feathers and wax for his son. He warned Icarus, "If you fly too high, the sun will melt your wings. If you fly too low, the sea's dampness will weigh you down." The story rang true to Desmond. The market's exuberance and implosion were in league with the allegory of Icarus. But so was life. People who flew too high, who lived beyond their means and ability, were bound for failure, as were those who never took a chance. Despite his belief that his emotional growth had plateaued indefinitely, Desmond interviewed several psychotherapists. One suggested he talk to a firm that was developing a novel therapy. It was experimental, he said, but worth checking out. The company was called Rapture Therapeutics. Desmond was stunned when he heard the name. He still remembered it from Cynet. It was one of the three mysterious companies that had been funded by Sitium Holdings and Invisible Sun Securities. A week later, he sat in Rapture's office in San Francisco. The company's chief scientist held up a pill. "This is a 50-milligram antidepressant. You and I could both take the same 50-milligram pill, and you might have four times the physiological reaction that I do. What's the difference? It's the way your body metabolizes the drug, how it processes it. For doctors and for patients, that's a problem."
"What's the solution?"
"Bypassing medicine altogether. At Rapture, we've built an implant that's placed inside the brain. It monitors brain chemistry and releases chemicals the brain needs, when it needs them. Imagine a world without schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or depression, just to name a few. The market potential is nearly unlimited."
"I'm interested. I've tried medication, but it hasn't worked for me. What I'm most interested in is memory alteration."
The scientist scrutinized him.
"What do you mean?" "I'm interested in erasing painful memories. Starting over, if you will."
A pause. "We don't currently have a technology or procedure to do that, Mr. Hughes.
But you're working on something."
"Nothing we're ready to discuss at this time." Desmond underwent the implant procedure. He kept his expectations low. Almost immediately, however, he felt results. The depression lifted. He was more excited about work. He looked forward to things. And he feared that it would all go away if the implant failed or if Rapture as a company folded. He became obsessed with the organization. He made calls, requested company filings that weren't public. He got nowhere. Finally, he requested a meeting with the CEO and CFO.
"I want to invest," he said.
The CEO's voice was flat.
"We're very well funded."
"By whom?"
"Our investors prefer to remain anonymous."
"Sitium Holdings? Invisible Sun Securities?" You could have heard a pin drop in the room. Both executives excused themselves. They were scared. Desmond researched Sitium and Invisible Sun endlessly. Some of their corporate filings were public by necessity. They owned shares in a dozen companies, and they had donated millions to nonprofits and foundations he had never heard of. The nonprofits were funneling all that money into research at government and private organizations. They were funding projects in genetics and medical science, advanced energy technologies, and supercomputing. What did it mean? And why were they so secretive? Increasingly, Desmond became consumed with unraveling the Sitium mystery. But try as he might, he couldn't connect the dots. Every avenue led to a dead end. For the most part, he lived a solitary life. He owned a small house in Menlo Park, rode his bike to work every day, and occasionally had lunch with an old colleague. He watched his investments grow, and the seasons change like a time-lapse photograph, his own life in fast-forward, slipping away. He thought about Peyton almost every day. He had set up a web search alert for her name. He opened the emails instantly whenever something popped up. She graduated from medical school, began her residency, was accepted to the CDC's EIS program. That made him happy. She had kept her promise to move on with her life. Like Desmond, she had lost many of the people she had come to love. Her father, brother, and now him. He hoped she wouldn't suffer his fate. He wanted to see her fall in love, get married, have children. He knew that was what she wanted deep down, no matter what she said. To him, the most terrifying possibility was that her time with him had made her unable to love. That by being with her, he had infected her with the fear of commitment that lay deep inside him. On a cool November morning, a man pushed open the glass door to Desmond's office and strode inside. He was in his 60s or 70s, if Desmond had to guess, with short white hair and a pale face. His eyes were blank, unmoving, as if he were holding still for a medical procedure. Desmond hadn't bothered to hire an assistant. There wasn't enough work for one. He didn't have anything scheduled for that day. "Next Gen Capital is across the hall. I've come to see you, Mr. Hughes." "What's this regarding?" "Sishim Holdings." The words hung in the air, neither man moving for a moment. Desmond held out an arm. "Let's speak in the conference room, Mr. Pachenko. Yuri Pachenko." He walked past Desmond, seated himself, and declined an offer for water. He took his raincoat off, a light film of water on it. Scars covered his forearms, burn scars, similar to the ones on Desmond's legs. Desmond immediately averted his eyes when he realized what they were. In a slow, level voice, Yuri asked, "What are you trying to create here, Mr. Hughes?" His English was excellent, his accent slightly British. "Please call me Desmond. If you're asking about Icarus Capital, we invest in companies with the potential to shape the future. We..." Yuri held a hand up, waited for Desmond to stop. "You misunderstand me. I'd like to hear what you don't tell everyone who walks through your door. Tell me your true vision, the one you think might scare people, the one you fear is too grand." Desmond leaned back in the chair. There was something about this man, his serenity, his directness. Desmond instantly felt a level of trust with Yuri. He let the words spill out. He was almost shocked to hear himself saying them. "I want to create a world where no child has to watch their family burn. Where no child is raised by someone who doesn't love them. A world where madmen don't fly planes into buildings and the economy's more than a worldwide casino." "And what else?" Desmond hesitated, glanced away. "That's the world you want to create. What do you want, Desmond?" "I want to create a world where any person can be repaired, no matter how broken their body or mind or heart." A smile curled the corners of Yuri's mouth. "You think that's possible?" "I believe we're witnessing the beginning stages of a technology explosion that will someday make anything possible." "What if I told you that the technology you're describing is already in development? Is that what Sishim is building?" "Among other things." "What sorts of other things?" "Projects that would interest you. Projects that would give you what you so dearly desire. Purpose. The potential to truly change this world. Are you interested, Desmond?"
"Yes."
They spoke for almost 2 hours. At the end of their meeting, Desmond committed to come to London, where more details would be revealed. As he was walking Yuri to the door, he asked, "What's it called, the device you're building?" "The Looking Glass." Day 11. 5,200,000,000 infected. 2 million dead. Chapter 75. The Red Cross plane flew through the night over the Atlantic toward the Shetland Islands, roughly 100 miles north of mainland Scotland. Over Spain, Avery had made a tough decision to fly around Great Britain and Ireland. They'd been lucky that no planes had intercepted them while crossing continental Europe. She was less optimistic about flying over the UK, but going around meant burning more fuel, so it was a costly gambit. As the southern tip of Shetland loomed, 50 miles away, the plane's engines began sputtering. She wiped her palms on her pants, depositing the nervous sweat. She gripped the yoke and disabled the autopilot. As she began their descent, she realized fuel wasn't their only problem, or their biggest. In the passenger compartment, the sound of the sputtering engines woke Peyton. She lay in a sleeping bag on the plane's floor, facing Desmond. He was looking back at her. The engines sputtered again. The plane was descending rapidly. Desmond realized it too. He stood, gripped the back of a chair, pulled himself toward the cockpit door, and threw it open. Peyton followed close behind. In the pilot's seat, Avery was frantically twisting dials on the instrument panel. In her headset, she said, "Scatsta, ATC, do you copy?" Through the plane's windshield, Peyton saw a wall of white. The cloud broke, and she got her first glimpse of the ground. Dark green rolling hills, poking through a blanket of thick fog. The night sky was streaked in shades of bright green and blue. She'd never seen anything like it. It took her breath away. She knew what she was seeing. The Aurora Borealis. It seemed to be pointing their way, fighting a losing battle with the fog. A wind shear hit the plane. Peyton lost her balance and fell into Desmond, who steadied himself with one hand and caught her with the other. Instead of releasing her, he kept his arm around her, gripping her shoulder, pressing her body to his. "How's it going, Avery?" "Peachy." She didn't look back. She worked the yoke, trying to keep the plane level. "We're out of fuel. No visibility. Gale force winds. Air traffic control isn't responding." The plane rocked again in the force of the wind. "Oh, and I should also mention, this is by far the largest plane I've ever flown. Just saying." Desmond took his arm away from Peyton, leaning forward to make eye contact with Avery. "Look, you can do this. We're not expecting a miracle, okay? Just slow it down and get us on the ground." Avery said nothing, only nodded. "How can we help?" The sarcasm was absent from Avery's tone when she replied, "Just strap yourself in tight, make sure there are no loose items, and put your helmet and body armor on." In the passenger compartment, Desmond helped strap Avery's body armor onto Peyton. She inhaled sharply when he tightened the strap. Her chest was still badly bruised from her escape from the Kintaro Maru. "Too tight?" he asked. She gritted her teeth. "It's fine." They put helmets on and buckled themselves into seats along the aisle, away from the plane's sides. As the wind tossed the aircraft, Peyton stared at the aurora. Streaks of light green crossed the sky in curving forms, as if an artist had painted the black sky with phosphorescent paint. They were dropping quickly now. The wind picked up with each passing second. Peyton put her hands on the seat in front of her and braced herself. Outside the windows, the aurora disappeared, replaced by fog. The tires barked as they caught pavement. The plane shuddered and barreled down the runway, then bounced and shook when it slipped off the pavement. Seconds later, it came to a halt. Desmond unbuckled himself, sprang up, and opened the cockpit door. Avery was standing. He grabbed her by the shoulders. "Good flying, eh?" Peyton thought he was going to embrace Avery, but he held her at arm's length, staring at her. Avery smiled. "If anything had been on the runway, we'd be dead," she said. "But it wasn't. You did great." Avery looked exhausted. Peyton realized she hadn't seen the woman sleep since their escape. She looked like she might collapse right then and there. Instead, she marched into the passenger compartment and stopped in front of Peyton. "I need my body armor." Peyton didn't like the woman's brusqueness, but with a nod, she stripped the black garment off, a little self-consciously, as if she were on display. Avery donned it, grabbed her rifle and night vision goggles, and turned to Desmond. "We need to secure the tower and refuel. If we get jammed up here, I want to be ready to bug out." When Desmond and Avery were gone, Peyton finally relaxed. The plan called for her to wait in the plane for now, which was fine by her. She felt the fever she had barely noticed before. Her mind's eye flashed to the people at Mandera Hospital, suffering, dying, without a cure that would likely be her fate. She had traveled to Mandera almost a week ago. As she assumed she'd been infected for 5 to 7 days, she pushed the thought out of her mind. She had to focus. She set about organizing their supplies and strained to hear any sound of gunfire or struggle. The fog was still thick on the runway and around the plane. After what seemed like hours, she heard someone jogging on the paved runway. The sound stopped when the person or persons hit the grass near the plane. Instinctively, Peyton moved to the cockpit, ready to close the door and seal herself off if necessary. Boots pounded the staircase, and Desmond appeared in the doorway.
Miss me?
Peyton exhaled.
You scared me to death.
Outside, she heard the roar of a truck engine.
What'd you find?
The airport is deserted. There's a fuel truck. We're gonna fill up, get the plane back on the runway, and get ready in case we need to leave in a hurry.
When they had the plane fueled and back on the runway, the three of them sat in the passenger compartment. To Desmond, Avery said, any memories?
Nothing.
Peyton was amazed at how easily he lied. It scared her a little. Avery's reaction gave no hint as to whether she believed him. They discussed what to do next, finally agreeing that Avery needed to sleep, and that Desmond and Peyton would take one of the airport vehicles to the GPS coordinates. They would radio back if they needed help. Avery didn't like it, but she reluctantly consented. Not only did she need the sleep, but splitting up had one advantage. If something did go wrong at the site, she could come looking for them and potentially rescue them. Desmond and Peyton found the keys to an old Citroën SUV in the airport's office and pulled out onto a paved two-lane road that wound through the green rolling landscape. The GPS location was about 40 miles from the airport in an area of wooded hills. The fog hung heavy on the road. The headlights barely cut through it. The aurora loomed above, its green glow like a homing beacon. Peyton studied the aurora's curving lines. They were like the plasma contrails of a spaceship in a sci-fi movie. As Desmond drove, he told Peyton what he'd remembered. For a very long time, Peyton had wanted to know what had happened after he left her on the doorstep of their little bungalow in Palo Alto. She had thought about him for countless hours since that day. Hearing the full story was nearly surreal to her. A blank page of their life together now filled in. Desmond's memories ended with Yuri Pachenko walking into his office in Menlo Park. The description of the man was vaguely familiar to Peyton. So was the name, but she couldn't place either one.
Do you know where they're keeping the cure? She asked.
No.
He glanced over at her.
Did you ever get married?
Peyton shook her head.
Because of me.
Because of life, Desmond. It's not your fault, and it's in the past, okay?
Not for me.
They rode in silence a moment. Peyton spoke first. Do you remember Avery?
No.
I still don't trust her.
Same here. But she's given us no reason not to yet.
Peyton changed the subject. How do you feel?
Like my head's gonna split open.
He studied her.
What about you?
I'm fine.
Be honest. You're getting worse, aren't you?
Getting sick's an occupational hazard. I accepted the risks when I went to work at the CDC.
Well, I don't accept it.
Peyton stared out the windshield.
You're not gonna die like this, Peyton.
She massaged her aching neck. The turbulent landing had done more damage than she'd realized. I'm usually the one telling sick people I'm going to fix them.
Well, I think you deserve a week off.
They drove in silence after that. Peyton didn't see a single building outside. No homes, no businesses. Except for the paved road that carved through the hills, this place was untouched by civilization.
We're coming up on it, she said as she studied the Labyrinth reality app. 100 yards to destination.
Desmond slowed the car.
Direction?
Roughly 10 o'clock.
The road curved to the right. There was no driveway or path leading in the coordinates direction. Desmond pulled the car off the road and parked.
Stay here.
No way.
Peyton?
I'm coming with you.
All right, he said, resigned.
It was the reaction of someone who had been married 20 years and knew when an argument was futile. Outside the car, they crept into the forest. The ground rose with every step. The road sat in a valley. Ancient evergreen trees surrounded them. Between their canopy and the fog, the light of the moon and the aurora faded away.
Peyton could see less than 20 feet ahead of them. She touched Desmond's shoulder and pointed at the flashlight she held, silently asking him if she should switch it on. He shook his head no. His rifle was slung over his shoulder, a handgun in one hand. With his other hand, he reached back, took Peyton's hand, and led her through the dark forest. It was utterly quiet. She heard no animals stirring, no birds calling. When she stepped on a branch and snapped it, the sound seemed deafening. Desmond froze. "Sorry," she whispered. He waited for any reaction, any sound, but the forest remained still and quiet. "Distance?" Peyton activated the phone. 30 yards, dead ahead. Desmond crept forward, the gun held out now. Peyton held her breath as they walked the last 10 yards. The fog seemed to close in on all sides. The phone beeped. A message popped up. "Labyrinth entrance reached." Desmond took the flashlight from her hand, turned it on, and panned around the area, cutting through the fog. Suddenly he stopped. Peyton saw it too. Her first thought was, "It's going to explode." Chapter 76. Desmond crept toward the small metal box that lay on the ground. "Stay back," he whispered. "Could be booby-trapped." She retreated behind a tree 10 yards away and watched him draw his fixed-blade combat knife. With a serrated edge, he sawed a limb off a nearby tree, cut the branches off, and used it to flip the box open. To Peyton's relief, nothing happened. Still cautious, Desmond stepped forward. He bent down, drew a small scrap of paper from the box, and exhaled. "It's a new set of GPS coordinates," he said. "Where?" Peyton asked. He took the phone out and typed on it. "Still in Shetland, maybe 20 or 30 miles from here, I think. We can drive." An alert popped up on the phone screen. It was a message from the Labyrinth Reality app. "One entrance located." She showed the message to Desmond. He paused. "It's the same message as before, when I opened the app in Dadaab." He took the phone and clicked the message. A map appeared. The location was in Australia, in the southern half, near the coast. It was rural, and as Desmond zoomed in, Peyton saw a dark spot in a green and brown landscape. He zoomed to the maximum, and Peyton's mouth went dry. Desmond was silent. They had gone there together, 15 years ago, to Desmond's childhood home. The burned remains were more overgrown now, but the charred foundation of the old ranch house still rose above the weeds. There was no indication anything had changed, but Peyton didn't know how old the satellite images were. Someone or something could be there now, or could have been hidden there, just like at this location. "What do you think?" she asked. He glanced at the phone, then at the scrap of paper with the nearby GPS coordinates. "I say we check out the coordinates here, then we can decide on going to Australia." "Should we call Avery?" Peyton asked. "No, not until we know what's going on." A tree-mounted, motion-activated wireless camera came to life when Desmond entered the scene. The individual had been monitoring the feed, woke, and watched anxiously. It wouldn't be long now. Desmond and Peyton drove through the night. The fog was still heavy, but Peyton thought it was starting to lift. A constant breeze buffeted the car, as if they were driving through a giant wind tunnel. The road curved left and right as they went deeper into the mountains of Shetland. At 500 yards from the destination, a dirt road split off from the paved road. Desmond leaned over and saw on the phone that it led to the coordinates. He reached into his backpack and pulled the night vision goggles out. He cut the car's headlights as he pulled the goggles on and started down the dirt road. 300 yards later, he killed the engine. "We'll hike in." They walked along the tree line of the dirt road, which weaved through the forest seemingly arbitrarily. It ended in a clearing with a small cottage. There was no sign of life, no lights glowing through the windows, no smoke rising from the chimney. The rubble stone exterior was shades of gray and blue and purple. Moss grew on the wooden roof. The place looked ancient, as if it had been built in the Middle Ages and abandoned. In the dim light, Desmond gave Peyton a look that said, "Stay here." He didn't wait for her to respond, merely handed her the key to the car and ran toward the cottage, rifle held at the ready. Peyton held her breath as he went around the right side of the house. 10 seconds passed, then 20. Lights came on, the front door opened, and Desmond walked out onto the porch. He waved her toward the house. When she reached the steps, he said, "You gotta see this." She stepped inside and stared. Cork covered the walls, and pictures, articles, and scribbled notes were tacked everywhere. Peyton recognized some of the names: Rapture Therapeutics, Faith on Genetics, Rook Quantum Sciences, Rendition Games. There were pictures of Desmond and Connor. She scanned the scribbled notes. Invisible Sun, person, organization, or project? What requires that much energy? Third world used as a testing ground? Some of the newspaper clippings went back as far as the 80s. Whoever had lived here was obviously investigating the Sishium. Had been for a long time, and they'd only recently left. In the kitchen, dishes with food particles lay in the sink. On the kitchen island, a laptop sat closed. "The place has power," Desmond said, turning on a small space heater. Peyton was glad for the warmth. "There's a solar array behind the house, and likely on the backside of the roof. It's completely off-grid, though." Three filing cabinets lined one wall. Peyton was about to open the first when Desmond called out, "Over here!" He stood in the living room, tapping his foot on a floorboard. "You hear that?" Peyton shook her head. "What's he doing?" He grabbed a fire poker that hung beside the stone hearth, jammed it into the floor, and pried the board loose. A safe lay underneath, with a dial lock. Desmond worked faster, ripping the adjacent boards free until it was completely uncovered. He gripped the dial and began spinning it. Peyton crouched beside him. "You know the combination?" "Maybe," he mumbled. He tried the handle, but it didn't budge.
"What did you try?"
"The combination to Orville's safe." Peyton instantly realized his theory.
He thinks he created all this, that it's his research.
He glanced at her. "Ideas?"
When they had found the box in the woods, Peyton had wondered why someone would have hidden GPS coordinates there. Why they were given two locations instead of just being directed straight here to the cottage.
"The first location, it has to serve a purpose."
Desmond nodded. "Yes. Maybe it was to ensure the right people found this place, and that they had the key to finding whatever's hidden here."
He spun the dial again, using the GPS coordinates of the first location. The handle clicked this time, and he pulled the metal door open. A stack of pages lay inside.
The top sheet had a single line of text, handwritten, in large block letters. "How the Sishium lost its way." Desmond flipped the page over, revealing a handwritten note below. He and Peyton read it together. "If you're reading this, the worst has occurred. The world will soon change. The enemy we face is more capable than any government or army the world has ever seen. I believe, however, that they can be stopped. To do so, you must understand their origins, their history, and their true intentions. The pages included here reveal those things. It is the greatest and perhaps only weapon I can offer you. First, you should know that the Order of Sishium began with good intentions. They were a noble organization, a group of faith. They had rituals and beliefs, though they recognized no deities. They worshipped at the altar of science, and in science they believed they would find answers to our deepest questions, including one in particular that they called the Great Question: why do we exist? They went to great lengths to pursue that answer, but they lost their way. In a desert in New Mexico on a July morning in 1945, an event occurred that changed the Sishium forever. I know of that transformation because my father witnessed it. I have enclosed his story, which I have rewritten based on what he told me. The remainder of the pages contain my own story. I hope it will lead you to the key to stopping the Sishium. Hurry. William."
"William," Peyton said. "There's no last name. Do you remember him?"
"No." Desmond studied the pages under the letter, scanning them. "But I take it he was one of my allies. Maybe an informant."
"Makes sense. What do you want to do? Should we call Avery?"
"No," he said quickly. "Let's see what we've got here. Read this, then search the rest of the house."
Peyton agreed, and they sat down on the worn couch in the living room. It was in the low 40s outside, and it felt even colder inside.
The small heater wasn't enough. She glanced at the fireplace but decided the smoke it would generate would be too much of a risk. She opted instead to drape the thick quilt from the couch over her, and she slid closer to Desmond and spread it across him as well. The warmth of their body heat slowly filled the small space under the quilt. He studied her face. She knew what he was thinking. This was just like Palo Alto, that small house they'd shared 15 years ago. She felt it too, them slipping back into that place they had been in together. But there was too much going on for her to even think about that. She lifted the pages and began to read. Chapter 77. My father's name was Robert Moore. He was a scientist at perhaps the most important time and place for scientists, a moment when science ended a war and changed the world. On that day in July 1945, he slept only 1 hour, dressed in his best suit, and drove through the desert to the test site. At the gate, security made him step out of his car, which they searched extensively. The mood across the base was tense. Inside the control station, the project director was bordering on a breakdown. Several times, General Leslie Groves had to guide the man outside, where they walked in the darkness, through the rain, talking, the general assuring him all would go as planned. Shortly before 5:30 a.m., the countdown began. The seconds were the longest of Robert's life. The team had nicknamed the device the Gadget. It was the product of half a decade of work by some of the greatest scientific minds ever assembled. That morning, the Gadget sat atop a 100-foot-tall steel tower. Desert stretched in every direction. The control station where the scientists waited was nearly 6 miles away. Even at that distance, Robert donned welder's goggles and focused through the tinted glass. He saw only darkness in the seconds before the countdown reached zero. The flash of white light came first. It lasted for a few seconds, then a wave of heat passed through him, soaking his face and hands. When the wall of light faded, he could make out a column of fire rising from the site, expanding quickly. The cloud broke through a temperature inversion at 17,000 feet, which most scientists had thought impossible. For minutes after the explosion, the cloud rose into the sky, reaching the substratosphere at over 35,000 feet. 40 seconds after the detonation, the shockwave reached the scientists in the control station. The sound of the blast followed shortly after. It had the quality of distant thunder, reverberating off the nearby hills for several seconds, giving the impression of a rolling thunderstorm. The sound was heard up to 100 miles away. The light from the explosion was seen from almost twice as far. The blast instantly vaporized the steel tower that held the bomb, leaving a crater nearly half a mile wide in its place. An iron pipe set in